This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 18th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show in association with Mubi. Today's edition of The Cinema Show, we're switching into warp speed and taking off for galaxies far, far away as we profile the intergalactic world of science fiction. Coming up, composer and filmmaker Michael Nyman on how music tells its own story.
When there's some strange kind of integration of what I do as a composer with what, on this occasion, I do as a filmmaker, you can't really take one thing away from another.
Plus, from ray guns to the Death Star, we'll examine how box office returns have shaped the evolution of science fiction pictures.
Now, really, the vast majority of big franchise movies are science fiction. You're very rarely going to find a Rocky or a Commando or any of those films coming back out as a big genre films. And that's switched on the back, essentially, of Star Wars, but on the back of the fact that no one expected it to follow up.
And how do technological innovations shape our fictional view of the future?
When asked how he was going to update the movie or the look of the Star Wars universe after 30 years, he didn't kind of just come up with, you know, his own ideas. His thought process was, well, what would Apple have done?
That's all to come on The Cinema Show with Mubi, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from the Everyman Cinema here in London's Marylebone today. And if it seems as though everywhere you look, you only see Star Wars, well, you're not alone. But we're taking a slightly different take today because, of course, the world of George Lucas, Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker would not be the richly engrossing and seemingly never-ending story that it is if it were not for many other films before it. Well, here to guide us through the wormhole of science fiction evolution is journalist and aspiring intergalactic explorer, Stephen Armstrong. Stephen, thanks very much for joining us here at the cinema. Now, of course, we are surrounded by a lot of people who are waiting, well, they're waiting very patiently at the moment, at least. We're still a little while away from the next screening to see the new Star Wars film. But just before we get into any of that, take us back, if you will, to a little bit before Star Wars was really hitting cinemas. I think it's fair to say that the beginnings of science fiction as we know it today owes a lot to the paranoia that really took over the cinema back maybe towards the 1940s and 50s, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, science fiction itself, really, if you think about the genesis of the whole genre, if you look back to something like War of the Worlds back at the turn of the century, this idea of humanity terrified that aliens were going to come from the planet Mars. A lot of that was really probably fantastical pre-World War fear of the other, a fear of an invasion. And if you look at the way that science fiction in the 40s and 50s depicts what space represents, it tends to represent a threat from outside. It represents aliens landing, or worse, aliens coming from within, the invasion of the body snatchers, that kind of thing, which feeds very directly into Cold War fears, the idea of communists overseas, communists in America rising up to take control. A lot of the stories, the Manchurian Candidate, those kinds of things, are about what happens if people take control of you and how to fight back against that. And that really becomes the narrative almost until the beginning of the Vietnam War, at which point science fiction starts to get violent.
Well, of course, we are here at the cinema today because it is very much Star Wars fever taking over all over the world, especially here in London, of course. But take us back a little bit, because, of course, Star Wars began in the 1970s and the genre of science fiction was very much into full swing by then. What do you think are the key films along the road that have really represented the turning point? I'm picking up things like Forbidden Planet being the perfect example of that 1950s style of science fiction. But then not too long after that, you've got films like Solaris that really, really had a very, very different take on the entire world of science fiction, and 2001 A Space Odyssey being another key title as well. What to you are the titles that really stick out as the defining beacons?
I think one of the most interesting things about Star Wars, when you look at it contextually, is that it was one of the first science fiction films in which the technology is a bit rubbish and a bit incidental half the time. So quite a lot of the time you have technology that doesn't quite work. The land speeder is a bit shonky, and there's assumptions about the kind of equipment that's there rather than wonder at the equipment. And that begins to tee up what eventually becomes quite a strong trope in the 90s, the dystopian, 80s rather, the dystopian idea, the Blade Runner, the idea that you're in a future where the technology's there and it's not all powerful, it just doesn't quite work, it's a bit rubbish, being on Earth is a bit terrible. So you're starting to see this idea that technology isn't necessarily the enemy or the friend. What it does is it fails and it's dirty and it's messy. That begins to thread through right up until the present day, where Ridley Scott's contemporary story is a science fiction reimagining of post-war America, which the Nazis and the Japanese had won. And that has the same idea of technology being a little bit rubbish and the human story playing out on top of that. Then in the 80s you get these human superhero science fiction stories, and Arnold Schwarzenegger tends to play a lot of those roles in Total Recall, those sorts of things, Alien versus Predator, where you've got humanity pitched against technology and coming through as a winner based on brawns and muscle and good old sort of one, you know, individualist values, almost like a Western, if you like, playing out on a science fiction scale. And then gradually again in the 21st century we start to get into science fiction as a metaphor for social fears. If you look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy, it reads to me very much as an ISIS film. It's about the rise of a dark force in a particular way, and it's combated in a particular way, and it does feel very much that people are responding to the threats of the Middle East and almost going back to the 1950s idea of sci-fi.
Stephen Armstrong, we'll come back to you a little later in the show. For now though, let's think about technology, whether it's the famous transporter from Star Trek whisking Captain Kirk down to various planetary surfaces via a quick blurry haze, or perhaps the typical ray gun, as seen in many sci-fi stories from the 1898 novel Edison's Conquest of Mars to today's Doctor Who television series. So do real-life technological innovations influence science fiction writers, or is it more the other way around? Mike Murphy is a writer for Quartz over in the US. Here's what he had to say.
I think it's very interesting, really. If you look at the way that we used to think about that fantasy world, the science fiction world, it used to be these kind of faraway or kind of unbelievable ideas. And let's say, you know, you look at Star Trek in the 60s and Star Wars in the 70s, they're set in distant planets with fanciful beasts and things like this. But kind of the kids who grew up on those movies are now our scientists and our engineers, and over the years have been influenced by those to the point where the things that they thought of or they saw as fanciful back in the day have actually become our commonplace technologies, to the point where when it comes to movies, it's almost difficult to come up with something that's going to be equally as amazing. You know, when you think about on Star Trek that they had these tablet computers that they could do everything on, and, you know, at the time we barely had a computer smaller than the room we're currently in. And now, you know, go down to Dixon's and buy an iPad for a few hundred pounds. So it's kind of hard to be as fanciful. So when it comes to the movies we have today, it's kind of more, a lot of the time, a mixing of, you know, real technologies in situations that may in some way be possible. I think a good example of that has to be The Martian from earlier this year. You know, some of the, you know, there's a few things that are probably 10 to 20 years away, but they're things that NASA are working on and have said that they're working on. But for the most part, they're using Toshiba laptops and GoPro cameras throughout the movie. So there's definitely this bend, both in terms of technology, but I think in terms of film in general, towards the real and things that, you know, maybe make it easier for the audience to kind of grasp onto, because they could actually go and get a lot of this stuff.
Captain's log, stardate 7413.4. Thanks to Mr. Spock's timely arrival and assistance, we have the engines rebalanced into full warp capacity. Repair time, less than 3 hours. Which means we will now be able to intercept intruder while still more than a day from Earth.
I think that when it comes to the way that we express ourselves, you know, back then we had no frame of reference in our daily lives in terms of technology, you know. In the 50s, the most advanced things in your house were probably your refrigerator and your radio. And so the idea of having, you know, rocket ships, and that was even still 15, 20 years away. Everything about those was fanciful, whereas now we very much express ourselves through our phones and our digital daily lives, to the point where I'm not sure what we can actually express with these new kinds of technologies. I mean, there's, you know, maybe a good example is the movie that just came out last night, Star Wars.
Ugh, where is R2 when I need him? Sir, I don't know where your ship learned to communicate, but it has the most peculiar dialect.
Even though it's set in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, it is still, there are these technologies that kind of we can't possibly have, like the lightsaber or something like that, which has become like a cultural touchstone in and of itself, this kind of fanciful technology. But at the same time, the costume designer for the movie, when asked a few months ago, I think it was in Vanity Fair, how he was going to update the movie or the look of the Star Wars universe after 30 years, he didn't kind of just come up with, you know, his own ideas. His thought process was, well, what would Apple have done? And in just as much the way that, you know, our world in the last 10, 15 years has been shaped by Apple, for better or for worse, it seems that real life is even influencing the fantastical.
Mike Murphy there, taking us on a tour through cinema's relationship with technology. Well, I'm back here at Midori House now to welcome a very special guest. He's the man behind some of cinema's most sublime soundtracks, and he's just recently put together his very own film. I speak, of course, of Michael Nyman. Welcome to The Cinema Show. Perhaps start us off with some of your thoughts on the role of music in telling a story. Now, because music does tell its own story, doesn't it? But in cinema, it's only part of the picture.
Well, I never think about, I mean, I'd always accept that what I write of necessity inevitably has some kind of narrative. Basically, I sit down and I manipulate sounds. And I create structures, and I don't necessarily think about a story or a narrative, even or especially when I'm writing music for something that is a story-based medium like film. But I mean, currently very involved in War Work, which is a film about the First World War that I made and directed and wrote the soundtrack for. And the strange way of producing this work, which is, it's either a film with music or music with a film or something that is kind of indefinably, indissolubly kind of linked, is that the music created its own narrative. So I wrote 19 soundtrack movements, which I never thought of as being narrative. And then I kind of superimposed images from French, German, American military archives, from the history of First World War painting, from photography, from texts. And it's very difficult to take one narrative away from another. This, you know, I think when it sounds very kind of Ponzi, but I think when there's some strange kind of integration of what I do as a composer with what, on this occasion, I do as a filmmaker, you can't really take one thing away from another. And the other thing that actually maybe is more important than narrative is actually emotion. Emotion is, like narrative, is something which seems to be contained within the materials and the process of creating the piece, but I don't necessarily think about it.
Now, listeners will likely align much of your work with the films of Peter Greenaway. You've also famously contributed to films like Jane Campion's Oscar winner, The Piano, and the beautiful 1997 science fiction film Gattaca, which I'd like to get to soon. First, though, you touched upon your War Work just then, which is, of course, your new piece of art that's just come out, and it's currently showing on Mubi, actually. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that, because it seems to me that stories tackling the subject of war set out to accomplish two things. They want to strike an emotional chord, and they also want to force us to consider the ideological so-called benefits of war. How did you approach that with War Work?
Well, first of all, I became a kind of unwilling student of very fat volumes, 800-page volumes of kind of pre-war, war, post-war history. That I live in Mexico, and every time I came back to London, I found, you know, Waterstones, there was yet another pile of First World War verbal bricks. And I looked at them, and I'd read the introduction, and, you know, the writer would say, expert X says this, expert Y says this, they're all wrong, I am the expert, I say this. And I thought if all the experts were disagreeing with each other, I can't make a First World War piece which tells the real story. So I then kind of set about finding this rather strange footage, which goes from, as I say, the extreme of the guy who's suffering from shell shock, to footage of beautiful young men, French soldiers, in their white shorts and singlets, training to be soldiers. And they're training to be soldiers in the way that you and I would have trained to do the high jump at infant school. So there's this kind of contrast between this rather beautiful, ludicrous preparation and the kind of effects. And as I say, there is history in it, but it's not a history. And it is the First World War, and unfortunately, it's all wars. And I think the kind of, you know, I feel as though I'm living in, we're all living in a kind of wartime situation right now. Maybe it's because I'm getting old, but I feel that there's more war in the world at the moment than I've ever known in my life, even though I was born at the end of the Second World War. And it's a kind of warning, but it doesn't need to be said. It's pointless. There's nothing to be learned except that the First World War, the war to end all wars, has probably, I don't know how many wars it's actually started rather than ended.
Well, let's move on now to another phase in your career, Michael, because I'd like to spend some time talking about a fascinating film that you worked on back in 1997, Gattaca.
The most unremarkable of events. Jerome Morrow, Navigator First Class, is about to embark on a one-year manned mission to Titan, 14th moon of Saturn. A highly prestigious assignment, although for Jerome, selection was virtually guaranteed at birth. He's blessed with all the gifts required for such an undertaking, a genetic quotient second to none. No, there is truly nothing remarkable about the progress of Jerome Morrow. Except that I am not Jerome Morrow.
It is, of course, the wonderful science fiction film set in a not-too-distant future, where a supposedly genetically inferior man, played by Ethan Hawke, assumes the identity of someone superior, played by Jude Law, so that he can pursue his lifelong dream of space travel. Michael, I was just re-watching the film this week, and despite being made in the late 90s, it bears almost no resemblance to most other films of that era. Now, this is the year that The Fifth Element hit cinemas, alongside Alien Resurrection and Men in Black, and George Clooney took that ill-fated step into the Batman franchise. The themes in Gattaca are quite timeless, though, which I guess is not so unusual in great films, but what really sticks out to me is how the visuals and music haven't dated at all either. Take us back, if you will. What was your reaction when you were first presented with the questions that are raised in the film?
Another Australian as well, Andrew Niccol. And kind of interesting that, you know, I think is Andrew's best film, and I think it's Jude Law's best film. So that's kind of interesting. Well, I found it very strange. I mean, Andrew came from, I don't know how this came about, and I remember going to see him in LA, and I said, you know, this is a science fiction film. I said, I don't do science fiction music. And he said, yeah, that's precisely why you're here. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the film depicts a society, as you say, as you described, you know, where there's really kind of no life of the emotions. And what my music does really well is to present a world of emotion. Now, this is kind of interesting because I'd always considered myself, since I started writing music in the mid-70s, to be a kind of emotion-free zone, to be a structuralist, to someone who put patterns together. But in putting all those patterns together, you know, whether it's for the piano or for any other film, you know, there's a narrative of emotion, just to use two of our favourite words. And so Andrew said he basically wanted me and my music to put the humanity back in a society where, as you say, things were to do with kind of genetic manipulation and genetic suitability for various tasks.
The visuals in Gattaca are also quite striking. We've got Frank Lloyd Wright's Marin County Civic Centre, which was built in 1960 in California, the Otis College of Art and Design, not far from LAX, and the CLA building at California State Polytechnic University. It's beautiful, and yet the society that inhabits this beautiful world is cold, and as Ethan Hawke's character says, has mastered discrimination down to a science. Tell me about your view on how those themes blend with the visuals, which then translates into a musical soundtrack.
I think that this was largely an emotional response, strangely enough. I mean, there's also that scary quote, because basically it's about DNA and it's about genetics and it's about the genetic code. And I seem to remember there's one line that's either on the screen or spoken, which is something like, there's no gene for the human spirit or something like that. So there's a sense of loss, and there's a sense of representation of that emotional loss. And again, you know, if you'd spoken to me, you know, 10 years earlier in the kind of middle of my Greenaway period and talked about writing music for loss or human beings or, you know, putting faces on artists or whatever, I would have said to you, I would have said, forget it, mate. But the piano obviously did something, you know, the piano didn't change my musical viewpoint, but it added a big dimension, which suddenly made me a composer that you might turn to represent the human spirit or to represent human emotion.
Michael Nyman, it has been a pleasure. Still to come, we'll return to the Everyman Cinema to discuss how box office returns influence what we see in the cinema.
The Arctic is one of the more inhospitable places on Earth, but as Monocle's film crew discovered, there's a trove of stories to be told by the local media about the vast and varied Canadian Arctic.
You start looking at residential school relocation, you start looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women, you start looking at food security and the incredibly high suicide rate here in Nunavut. If we wanted to, as a network, just stick to those stories, we could be the saddest show on Canadian television. You have to balance some of that out with some uplifting stories to show people struggling against those conditions, but winning.
Reporting the Arctic, now showing along with over 500 more Monocle films and slideshows on monocle.com.
We are back at the Everyman Cinema here in Marylebone in London today, and it's getting incredibly busy here now because Star Wars is just about to take off for another screening. Still with me, Stephen Armstrong. Stephen, we were just having a chat there in the break about the role that box office plays in the kind of films that we've seen coming out over time. Give us a bit of your thoughts on how that has progressed over time, because, I mean, films that have had these big aspiring visions have kind of fallen flat in the past. I mean, I recall reading a story once, actually, that George Lucas had originally intended to make Flash Gordon, and when he could not obtain the rights, ended up writing Star Wars instead. I'm not entirely sure how true that is, but it does give you some idea as to how it sort of happens accidentally, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, well, having said that, yes, but that used to be the case. I think what we've achieved now is a state where the cinema industry has to invest so much money in a big Star Wars or a big science fiction film, particularly because they're hoping for it to become a franchise, that idea previously where George Lucas could take his book on script writing with the hero's journey and fit all seven heroes' journey into a film which he shot, you know, using the place names of the area he happened to find the location in, that's no longer an option for Hollywood. What Hollywood needs is something which they can predict the outcome of and then launch something else on the back of. So what we've tended to find is that the box office returns have been getting higher and higher and higher because people have been spending more on marketing and the price of cinema seats have been coming up. But the picture isn't necessarily as clear when you look at the number of people going to see a film. The big talk with this current Star Wars film is, will it beat Avatar at the box office? Avatar, the highest grossing film of all time. When you look at the number of tickets sold per movie, Avatar's not even in the top 10. The big selling movies, if you equate ticket prices, you know, equally, films like Gone with the Wind or The Exorcist or 101 Dalmatians all outperform Avatar. So it's the way that the financing is structured that makes these films seem so huge. They charge more money, but they don't necessarily attract as many people.
So we are living in a very different time today where people come to the cinemas for lots of different reasons, and there's a lot of stiff competition that relates to that as well. So to entice people to pay the much higher prices that cinemas charge today, that really relates to a very different funding body, doesn't it? So when you reflect on the box office and the sorts of films that have shaped the kind of genre films we see today, what are some of the patterns you see emerging?
I think what we see is a big change happening in the early 80s, where in the 70s you have films which are very much about the human condition. If something like Bonnie and Clyde is about a couple and they're placing them in a violent situation, what gradually happens over the course of the 80s is the what if becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and the idea of science fiction becomes more and more normalised as a mainstream form. When Star Wars began, calling yourself a science fiction fan was weird. You know, people would not, in much the same way that people still have that about Star Trek a little bit, it's just a little bit odd. But now, really, the vast majority of big franchise movies are science fiction. You're very rarely going to find a Rocky or a Commando or any of those films coming back out as a big genre of films. And that's switched on the back, essentially, of Star Wars, but on the back of the fact that no one expected it to follow up. If you look at the plot of Star Wars, it's a self-contained plot. He doesn't really have the ability to spin it out into part two and part three, with the exception of Darth Vader spiraling off at the end. He hadn't planned out that story until he worked out he had a success. Now, it's all foresight, it's all planning. This Star Wars, they know they're going to make two more Star Wars movies, they know the dates they're going to be released, and they know they're going to have a theme park afterwards. So the wiggle room, the mistake, the weird, oddball option that, if you like, created this particular genre, this particular market, no longer has space to exist.
I do have a Star Wars fan here with me, and we are inching ever closer to the next screening time, so we probably should chat to him now before he runs away. Farrell, you're here to see Star Wars. What are you looking forward to?
To be honest, I'm looking forward, I'm really excited for the movie, of course. I've been a big Star Wars fan since I was, in my diapers. I mean, even, since my mum is also a really big fan of Star Wars. Therefore, I'm really expecting a lot of my friends said it's, really similar to the old Star Wars compared to, the original trilogy, right? And, of course, I expect it to be really different from the original trilogy, because despite growing up with the original trilogy, with the new 1, 2, and 3, I really sympathize with the older generations who are they feel as if George Lucas has ruined their childhood. You know, I've even seen the documentary, George Lucas ruined my childhood. And even my mom said, George Lucas ruined my childhood. And, you know, especially with all the remasters, especially the one where they changed, you know, the ending scene of Return of the Jedi, where they changed the original actors to Hayden Christensen and the ending. I sympathize with them. And especially, you know, I'm excited, and especially with J.J. Abrams on the helm. He's done a really good job with all the Star Treks, and I'm excited for Episode 8. It's going to be directed by Rian Johnson, a great director. And Episode 9 is going to be directed by Colin Trevorrow, who's directing Jurassic World, which is... I like that movie. So I expect a lot of similarities, especially what really intrigues me at the moment is the fact that they've had Carrie Fisher and they've had Harrison Ford doing all the press, but they really never had Mark Hamill do any press. So I'm really interested what part Luke Skywalker plays in the movie. And I just really want to see the development of all the characters and to see what role does, the new character Finn, what's his development throughout the trilogy. So I'm very, very excited to watch it. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, the popcorn is popping away now. And we better let Farrell get off and see that screening of Star Wars. And as we just heard, there is really nothing more controversial than messing with science fiction. So thank you very much for joining us here at the Everyman Cinema. That does bring us to the end of this week's show. Special thanks to all of my guests, Stephen Armstrong, Mike Murphy, our friends here at the Everyman Cinema in Marylebone, and of course, Michael Nyman. War Work is showing now on Mubi, and keep an eye out for the accompanying album as well. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me by sending me an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.